Welcome to the Real Python Podcast. This is episode 306. How can you move from manually writing prompts for an LLM application toward defining them programmatically? This week on the show, Brett Kennedy returns to discuss his new book, Building LLM Applications with DSPy. With large language models becoming embedded in production software, manual prompt engineering becomes brittle, time-consuming, and difficult to maintain. Brett shares how DSPy replaces manual writing and adjusting prompts with structured prompt programming. We dig into how DSPy uses declarative signatures to define inputs and outputs. We also discuss how developers programmatically compile, tune, and optimize prompts for specific LLM-based tasks within an application. All right, let's get started. The Real Python Podcast is a weekly conversation about using Python in the real world. My name is Christopher Bailey, your host. Each week, we feature interviews with experts in the community and discussions about the topics, articles, and courses found at realpython.com. After the podcast, join us and learn real-world Python skills with a community of experts at realpython.com. Hey, Brett, welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, I'm excited to talk to you. You're on episode 208. Talking about outlier detection in Python in your book that you had on Manning. And Mr. Trudeau, I think, introduced me to you because he's also a Manning author.
That's right. Yeah.
And you're working on a new book that we're going to talk about this week. And it's definitely of the moment, speaking about LLMs and prompting and some of the stuff that may, I don't know, it's changed inside your life over the last couple of years here.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I just wrapping up another book with Manning Publishing about a tool for writing LLM applications, a tool called DSPy.
Yeah.
So the book's, it's available. It's not in print quite yet, but it is available for sale. You get an electronic copy now, or you can order a print copy and it'll just come once it's printed, which should be within a couple months.
Yeah. So you're using the same early access program that I've had a few different authors on. Mm-hmm. So you can kind of look at it digitally and even maybe provide feedback as it's going
along.
You
can. Right? Yeah. There's still a very small window to provide feedback left. But we have. Most of the feedback was quite positive. So, but we did get some and have incorporated that.
Yeah.
Next week or so, we'll probably be wrapping. But they're details.
You're writing with someone else this time.
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about Serge.
Yeah. So Manning actually approached Serge and I about doing this.
Okay.
Because, you know, it's a hot topic and wanted to get something out. And he has a little bit, probably, at least when we started, I think a little more experience using DSPy than I did. I had a little more writing experience. So
it's a good balance.
Yeah. And I think it worked out quite well. Yeah. I think we covered things a little bit more thoroughly and a little more, probably a little more innovative way of coming up ways to explain things more clearly than if we were just one of us. So yeah, no, it did work out quite well.
Yeah, I've talked to a few different pairs of authors on the show, and it always seems to improve the process. And I think it also maybe helps you from the abyss of writing a book sometimes.
I mean, how we often worked is he would do the first draft or two and I would do the subsequent ones. And some of the content was mine or something. But yeah, so I didn't really have writer's block issues or things like that. But but still, it can get a little confusing when you're writing these books. Like, how do I, because sometimes you're in these situations where, you have to explain everything before everything else for it to make sense. And you get into this kind of circle. Yeah. It can be a little bit tricky to find a logical order to explain things. So it goes from, simple to complex smoothly.
Yeah.
But that's the challenge of it. Yeah.
So the title is Building LLM Applications with DSPy. Mm-hmm. And DSPy is Declarative Self-Improving Python, which I think is a interesting name.
Yep.
And it's a project out of Stanford, right?
Yes.
I was reading a little background on it. It came out in end of 2022, which is kind of funny because that's really when, gosh, all the burners turned on the stove as far as LLM stuff.
Yes. Yeah. And yes, it's still a very valuable tool. But yeah, the LLMs themselves have changed a little bit since then. Yeah, so its original work came out of Stanford. A lot of the people that worked on it initially still work on it, though they're not necessarily with Stanford.
Yeah.
The main person behind it, probably the main, Omar Khattab, he's now at MIT and he has a job at Databricks. And
okay.
I think a number of them have gone to Databricks where they're just, you know, maintaining DSPy from there instead of, you know, as part of their PhD work or you know, whatever
okay.
capacity they were in at Stanford.
So what's the premise here? Like, what is DSPy? Like, if you could put it in a nutshell.
Nutshell, it's kind of like, it's a tool that does your prompt engineering for you.
Okay.
So it's kind of like having a, you know, like hiring a staff member, an assistant or something to, if you're writing a an LLM application, so you're writing a piece of software that part of functioning makes calls to LLMs to do some, you know, part of the work it's doing.
Okay.
Maybe most of the work it's doing. Doing that, you need prompts that work well with the LLM. They give you the kind of responses you want. And, you know, sometimes it can be a little bit tricky to get a really good response that can run reliably.
Okay.
And so what DSPy does is provides a kind of framework and infrastructure to optimize the prompt for you, but also evaluate it. Yeah, the idea is working with DSPy, you don't actually write the prompts.
Okay.
The framework will do that for you. You tell the framework what you want the prompt to do. So you say something like, I'm going to give you a document and return a summary of it, or return an explanation of how sensible this document is, or provide a critique of it, or whatever you want the LLM to do.
Okay.
You just provide instructions at a high level saying, you know, I'm going to give you this sort of input, and I want you, the LLM, to return this kind of output. And you do provide test examples. So you say, you know, with these test inputs, I expect these kind of outputs. If you can, yeah.
Yeah, I was thinking about that, like, that this is this process, they call it a signature, mm-hmm. where you're sort of declaring this task. And what I was wondering about as I was looking at it is, I know there's a lot of people in our world who are maybe not super fans of typing, potentially, but this seems to be kind of a crucial thing in the signature. Would you agree that typing is important in it?
Oh, yeah. Yes. Yeah, it can be. Yeah. So you say, I'm going to, if you want your response back in a JSON format or a CSV format or whatever, you can specify specifically, I want this field to be a date string and I want the date string to be numeric with, you know, year, hyphen.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, you can specify the format. It makes it pretty simple and straightforward to explain, you know, precisely what sort of input you'll get if it's relevant and what kind of output you want if that's important to you. And it makes things clearer for the LLMs too, because they can understand.
Right.
Okay, I'm going to get this field, and it's going to be in a floating point format, and it's going to be on, you know, a scale from 1 to 10.
Yeah.
And you know, this is what it means. Yeah, it makes it all pretty simple to do that.
Yeah. So you're kind of like, one of the ways they had described it as I kind of was briefing my way through it is a bit like designing a class a little bit. In Python, it could be one of the ways that you do it, mm-hmm. and that you would potentially put in there, like, okay, well, this is what this accepts. I always get into typing, I don't want to say disagreements, but basically like conversations about it, where it's really when you're talking to other systems and trying to send different information back and forth that you truly want to define, well, what am I, you know, looking for here, and how should it come back to you? Like, mm-hmm. Even in your summarization, you could be, you know, very specific, I would guess, and like, I want this many words, and I want it to definitely be a string, and, you know, or however you want it formatted, like it says it comes back in JSON or what have you. Mm-hmm. Is that kind of, you know, what all goes into that signature thing in your sort of initial prompting?
Yeah, it can go into the signature. Yeah. DSPy, how it normally works is you would give it kind of a high level description of what you want it to do.
Okay.
And you provide a way to evaluate the responses. And it's good to provide that sort of detail in the signature if you can, about, you know, what format you want and so on. But if you don't, DSPy will still figure out how to phrase the prompt.
It'll assist you.
Yeah.
Okay.
When you give it a signature, it's really just a starting point usually. And behind the scenes, it'll go off and optimize your prompt. So it includes all the sort of details, instructions that it needs, and demonstrations and so on, so that the LLM can get you what you want.
Before we get too far off of the main premise of why there is a need for a tool like this. Mm-hmm. Part of it that I've, you know, again, I did some cursory research, is that prompts can get really, really bloated. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, you know, this term of prompt engineering has been around for a while and do these types of things. And, mm-hmm. you know, maybe 2 years ago, they would include a bunch of other kind of weird additional things like you're a professional, you know, designer or whatever, these kind of like weird things like giving the model a title and
personas and yeah,
all these kind of little shiny bits that seem to trigger different things.
Yep.
And the problem with that is that that might potentially all give completely different results when the model changes.
Yes, that's 100% true. Yeah, when you learn these tricks and they work well for one LLM, and then you test on another LLM and you're back to trying, what does a persona help here? Does a chain of thought request help here? You know, and there's just dozens and dozens of these tricks we can use with the prompts. So and it's a real, if you do it manually, it's a really, really time-consuming process. Now, when you use DSPy, a lot of that process still needs to be done. I mean, it'd be done in a very efficient way,
okay.
But it's the framework doing it. It's not you.
Okay.
So that's the trick. It's kind of like if you're training a neural net, if you go way back, like 1950s, you know, people would manually set the weights for the connections, right? And it's a really slow way to work.
Yeah.
Whereas now, for training a neural net or an XGBoost model or random forest, whatever it is, you know, there's still the work that's done to tune this.
Okay.
But it's the framework doing it. It's not you. So you just provide it. You know, here's the test data. You know, you go off and find the set of weights for this neural net that work the best.
Okay.
So it's the same idea with DSPy. Like, you know, trying all these things like, you know, a persona or a chain of thought request or adding demonstrations or, you know, explaining why, you know, explaining why we need the, or how important the task is. You know, it's all these sort of tricks. DSPy is still going to be doing that.
Is that what comes in the modules? Is that kind of where all that kind of then comes to the next step?
More in the optimizers, but yeah.
Okay.
But you can create modules that will specifically use certain prompting techniques. Like one that DSPy ships with is called Chain of Thought, and it's just like a regular prompt, except it'll include a request to give you the reasoning.
Okay.
As well. Yeah, DSPy ships with a bunch of what are called modules. Yeah, they encapsulate a prompting technique. So it means you don't have to code these yourself. You can just write, you know, a loop that tries different modules. It's kind of like if you're working with an XGBoost model or a neural net or something, you would just kind of, you do hyperparameter tuning where you say, well, I'm going to try different techniques. And so with DSPy, you might do something like that where you don't have to manually try all these prompting techniques. You just code a loop and say, okay, try this, try that. And it'll just go off and, you know, spend some time and come back and
optimizing.
Optimize it. So you're trying to find the best prompting technique, but you're also trying to just find the best prompt. You know, it has what are called optimizers, which is really kind of like, I think maybe the most important concept in DSPy, though it's debatable.
So how would you describe an optimizer? What is it doing?
So what it's doing is, there's two types of optimizers. One is there's optimizers that try and figure out what demonstrations to add to your prompt.
Okay.
And that's a fairly simple idea, but it's interesting because the people at DSPy found that's actually often the most important form of tuning you can do is just find a good set of demonstrations to add to your prompt.
So these are like sort of not exactly test cases, but like sample prompts and then sample responses that you know, effectively show what it's supposed to be done.
Yeah. So if I were to give you this input, this would be a good output. If I were to give you this input, that would be a good output. And you just list, you know, 5 or 10 of these.
Okay.
And include that in the prompt. And that gives the LLM a good, you know, set of examples for what you're expecting. Hmm. And that works surprisingly well.
Okay.
And the other type of optimizer that DSPy provides are instruction optimizers. Like if you have a summarization task, you might just say, I'm giving you a document, give me a summary.
Okay.
And that's maybe that's really simple instructions. But if you're doing prompt engineering, like you're mainly trying to get a good prompt for this, you know, you'd probably test it, realize that didn't specify enough. So you have to say, well, I want the summary to be this number of words long, you know, in this kind of range. And I want you to include this sort of information. And I want you to not include that sort of information. And I want you to do this, use this kind of tone. And, you know, after a while, you're prompting it, you know, quite long and complicated. But if you use DSPy for your prompt engineering, you just start with something simple. You just say, I'm giving you a document. I want a summary.
Okay.
And you maybe specify a little bit more information. And it'll go off and try a lot of different prompts that it can use. And some of these prompts may be thousands of words long. Some of them may be simple. It'll, you know, try both. Yeah, there's four or five or six optimizers that DSPy ships with.
Okay.
Just over the years, they've just kind of created more and more sophisticated, more and more powerful ones. So one of the first ones they created, which worked well, but you know, it's been surpassed by some of the other ones they've added since then, is called Corpo. And you know, everything has acronyms in DSPy.
Okay.
It's one of the optimizers they add. And it uses a hill climbing method. So it's not the most powerful one, but it's fairly simple. It's easy to explain. So what it'll do, it'll sort of just, for a task you're trying to do, you want your software to perform, what it'll do is it'll just create a bunch of prompts for it, a bunch of candidate prompts. So it might create, like, say, 10 candidate prompts. It'll test each of them, evaluate each of them. So you do have to give it some test data so it can see how they're performing.
Okay.
So it'll try each of those 10. It'll take the best one, and then it'll create a bunch of variations on that. So maybe it'll create 5 variations on that. Evaluate each of those, take the best one, and then it'll create, you know, another 5 variations on that. Again, take the best one. So just, you know, each iteration, it just keeps getting a stronger and stronger prompt for as long as you want to let it run.
Yeah.
So you give it some budget for how long to run for, and
okay.
You have, go for 10 iterations and each time generate 10 prompts. So you're going to try 100 prompts in total. And it'll say, okay, when it's done, it'll say, I've tried 100 prompts. This is the one that works the best.
And it will give you like statistical evaluations on what's working?
Yeah. Yes, you can see, partially, for one thing, you can see, you know, is it still improving? Like if I let it run longer,
okay,
or is it kind of, does it appear to have leveled off? And when it appears to have leveled off, you never know if, you know, yeah. if you let it go, it could still do a little bit better. But, you know, at a certain point, they ask them to, you know, the LLM can only do so well, you know.
Yeah, sure.
At a certain point, you can only improve it by going to a smarter LLM. But,
right.
But, you know, one of the big advantages of DSPy is it lets you use LLMs that aren't cutting edge, like the sort of cheaper, faster LLMs.
You'll get good results potentially out of like maybe even local stuff, depending on what you're trying to do.
Even a local model. Yeah, yes. And if you can work with a local model, you're really saving a lot of money and time because, you know, you don't have the network time. And, you know, you eliminate your confidentiality issues and there's a lot of benefits to working with a local model or even a hosted model that's maybe, you know, cheap and without a tuned prompt won't work that well.
Could be like, in this case, slim down to a point that for the particular task that we're trying to do, this well-engineered prompt, you know, they'll pair nicely.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Okay.
So yeah, maybe it'll perform poorly with kind of your first attempt at a prompt, but you know, once you optimize it, it'll perform as well as a more expensive LM.
So some of the stuff that they talk about, and even in the beginning of your book, you kind of describe this idea of moving from engineering, of prompt engineering, mm-hmm. to, you know, what they're now theming as prompt programming.
Yeah.
And it's sort of like you're kind of, again, as many languages do, Python's a fairly high-level language. It mm-hmm. is fairly readable to humans. Mm-hmm. And in a similar way, prompt engineering, you look at these markdown files, and I haven't seen a lot of them, but I've seen examples online of some of the stuff, and it can get really messy and become difficult even for us to, you know, peruse and just look through, you know, and see what's happening. So it might be good to have something else you know, writing these and creating them in a way that works. Okay. But that's really the premise behind everything here.
I think so. Yeah. When at first, like prompts can get really hard to work with when they get big.
Okay.
Because, you know, often just to get a good solution, you have to create what we call like mega prompts or something. You know, it can be like hundreds, thousands of words long, and they work well. But then you want to try another LLM, or you want to try, you know, you have another test case that it's not working for, and or it's, you know, you want to prove it in some way. It's really hard to say, well, if I add a clause or if I remove a clause or reword a clause, reorder them, you know, what's the effect going to be on that? But yeah, getting to your point, like when I first learned DSPy, like what it really reminded me of a lot, because, you know, I'm old, is I remember when C++ compilers first came out.
Okay.
And when they first came out, at very first, they didn't produce that great of assembly code. Hmm. And it usually didn't matter, but for like high performance code, it did matter. So what people would often do is write their own assembly code, which is really, you know, slow.
For like specific functions again,
for specific functions. Yeah, like, where okay, it has
this,
to perform
this,
well.
This is the slow portion of my, you know, performance-wise, and I really need this to sing. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's not the case that the assembly was just wrong ever. I mean, maybe the very first. But yeah, it was more that it wasn't as performant as people needed, so they write their own assembly code.
Okay.
And then a couple, you know, within not too long, the C++ compilers were creating assembly code that was better than you could create. And you didn't have these issues.
Right. Optimizations again. Yeah.
Yeah, it was really optimized. And it just eliminated the labor of, you know, having to write your own assembly code.
Okay.
And the quality was higher. So, and I think it's kind of an analogy that it's just with DSPy, it's like, well, you know, why are we still writing prompts when LLMs are really good at writing prompts? And it's a slow, tedious process. It's really error prone. It's hard to do.
Yeah, I know so many people that try to do it just by speaking into the computer, and I can't imagine that's a very efficient process as far as, like, especially if you're including all the niceties and stuff that, you know, people tend to do in human speech, you know.
It's not, you know, if you're just interacting with the LLM, you say, okay, I have these ingredients, you know, what's a recipe I can make? Maybe that doesn't work well, so you have to reword your prompt a few times and things like that. It could be okay. But if you're writing an LLM application, that means you're writing software that's going to go off in production and run on its own.
Right.
So every time the LLM doesn't work well, you're not there to rewrite the prompt and try again.
Right.
Yeah, so you really have to make prompts that are robust and reliable that'll work, you know,
and unsupervised, potentially.
Running off its own. Yeah, so it's running at, you know, 3 a.m. and you're not around. And users are giving it input. You want it to give output that's good.
It's interesting because I don't think we talk about that a whole lot on the show, or haven't up to this point, that when you're creating a true application that it itself is interfacing with an LLM. Mm-hmm. Users are inputting information, and the application's sort of sitting in the middle, and now it's having to prompt based on what the inputs were from the customer or whatever, and then firing it off to the LLM, and then it's coming back in. And that's a whole different sort of ballgame comparatively to, you know, writing software, you know, from scratch. Like, I need this software to do this, and it's not a one shot, but it's like a progressive building kind of thing. This is something that's having to work in a real time situation, getting its own prompts, you know, if you will, or at least customer requests.
Yes.
I guess two questions there. One, can you use it in the other fashion? If you were wanting to use it to prompt to build applications versus potentially, you know, building prompts that sort of live in this sort of, you know, real world running thing, can it do both, or is it more optimized for the one?
For certain it can do both.
Okay.
Now, if you're writing a simple application, and if it's a one-off and you're able to handcraft a prompt that gives you an answer, and you got your answer and you're done.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, you probably don't need DSPy. Having said that, you know, once you learn DSPy, and it's not that hard to learn, if you know Python already, it's not that hard to learn.
Sure.
Yeah, I would just use it all the time just because, you know, once you know it, there's really no reason not to.
Okay.
It saves you work. So you end up with a prompt that's probably better than you would have come up with. And you get it for less labor.
Yeah.
Why would you not? Well, the only real reason you would not is if you're using another tool that's just like DSPy that does the same thing. But comparing it, and there are some, but saying like DSPy is probably this arguably, you know, the state of the art, at least at the moment. But the idea of manually going through this process, I couldn't see it. To me, it'd be like, you know, manually setting the weights in your neural net or manually writing your assembly code or you know, if you're writing a network code, manually creating your TCP packets. Like it just, you know, it doesn't really, you know, now that we have tools that do these things for us, you know, perfectly well.
Yeah, I was thinking about it, like who will be better at creating a prompt that is effective for an LLM, a human that's used to like speaking to other humans and trying to explain things to a machine or an LLM system that understands inherently like how an LLM functions and what are the best techniques for getting results. And
yeah,
that seems to me inherently a little bit what's happening. You know, LLMs are designed in a way, they're a bit of a black box. I mean, you can't like crack one open and read necessarily what's in there, though they might have some prompts in them, I've learned, right? As far as like tuning things and putting guardrails and stuff on.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
But they're kind of a unique thing. And so they key in different ways than human beings. So this kind of makes sense to me, like you know, what's happening here.
Mm-hmm.
And you're sort of decoupling tasks in a way, you know, kind of the same way that you know, we talk about moving to higher levels. And and then one of the things that we also mentioned here is a sort of future proofing, right? The idea that if a new model comes in, see how it performs, but it then can be part of that optimization process. Am I getting that right too?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. Yeah. And to your previous point, yeah, LLMs, you know, for whatever limitations they have, they are really good at writing prompts. It's one of the things they're really, really quite good at. But to your other point, yeah, once you write your code, and usually writing the code to create a prompt doesn't take a ton of code in DSPy. The bulk of the work is in collecting good test cases.
Yeah, okay.
But once you have your code, if you want to try another LLM, it's you change one line and then rerun it. And you wait. So say you give it 20 minutes or 30 minutes or 10 minutes, whatever you give it, you know, come back when it's done and you say, okay, this LLM with the first LLM, I tried, you know, 200 prompts and the best one got, you know, worked this well. And with this other LLM, I also tried 200 prompts and the best one worked this well.
Okay.
And so you can say, okay, I know how well they both work. I know how, you know, expensive both are. Maybe there's differences in terms of their privacy or context windows or speed.
Okay.
And you can say, okay, I can just decide which LLM to use, or I can try a third LLM. And again, it's just try a third. You don't have to rewrite any code. You just let it even if the two LLMs respond best to quite different prompts, you really don't have to update your code. You just let it re-execute.
That's cool. It's time to shine a spotlight on another RealPython video course. It's about a framework to help you build retrieval augmented generation apps using Python. Llama Index lets you load your data and documents, create and persist searchable indexes, and query an LLM using your data as context. In the course, you'll learn the basics of installing the package, setting AI providers, spinning up a query engine, and running queries against remote or local models. The video course is titled Using Llama Index for RAG in Python, and it's based on a written tutorial by Leodon Esposo Ramos. And in the video course, your instructor is Stephen Loyens. Through the course, you'll learn how to use Llama Index to connect your data to LLMs, allowing you to build AI agents, workflows, query engines, and chat engines, and perform RAG with Llama Index to retrieve relevant context at query time, helping the LLM generate grounded answers and minimize hallucinations. You'll start by preparing your environment and installing Llama Index, and from there, you'll learn how to load your own files, build and save an index, and then choose different AI providers and run targeted queries over your data through a query engine. RealPython video courses are broken into easily consumable sections, and where needed, include code examples for the techniques shown. All lessons have a transcript, including closed captions. And like most of the recent courses on RealPython, there are exercises woven along your path through the course to test your knowledge. Check out the video course. You can find a link in the show notes, or you can find it using the search tool on realpython.com. Tell me about how it's worked for you, like in the sense, like I'm guessing you've maybe thrown some of your own stuff at it. Again, you may not have, I think that might be some of the problem that a lot of people may not be in this situation as far as Python programmers. They might run into a super sticky problem, and this sounds like kind of a cool way to potentially have some help with, like, how can I re-engineer or modify my prompt to get it past this hurdle? But, like, do you have examples of how you've been using it?
Yeah. I mean, the bulk of using it is actually writing the book lately. But
sure.
I've also been using, and so, which meant I was kind of, you know, stressing it, you know, trying to figure out, you know, what all I can do. And also, where I've been using it since writing the book is actually using it with RAG applications and GraphRAG applications.
Okay.
Specifically. And it's really quite convenient for that. I should say, there's probably a few things DSPy provides for you. So one we've kind of talked about is it writes your prompts for you, it evaluates them, and it optimizes them. So that's the first thing. Another thing it provides for you is there's just a single API you use, really quite simple API, and you use it regardless of which LLM you're using. So if you want to work with an OpenAI LLM and you want to try a Gemini or Anthropic, whatever, you know, there's hundreds of LLMs out there. You do have to go get a key, but other than that, your code doesn't really change. So you just use the exact same code. So, you know, even though different language providers might have different signatures, your code doesn't have to change. That's all kind of abstracted away from you. LangChain provides okay. the same sort of functionality. And I'd say a third thing that DSPy provides is lets you code workflows, like fairly complex workflows, where you're maybe using tools or retrieving information from, like it's a RAG sort of a program where you're retrieving data from different sources.
So lots of multi-step processes.
Multi-step, yeah. Or even if you're just using a multi-step prompting technique, where like maybe you have a loop where you have an LM proposes a prompt, another LM executes the prompt, and then you have a critic LM that kind of says, how good is that response? Are we done yet?
Okay.
And if not, what's wrong with it? And then it just kind of loops like that. So creating, you know, workflows like that, even ones that are much more complex than that, you know, tree of thought or graph of thought or these sort of complex prompting techniques, DSPy makes pretty simple to code these.
You mentioned RAG.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of have two questions there. Let's say we blow out an example here to kind of like think about it a little more. You know, retrieval augmented generation, such a weird terminology. but the premise, you know, I had Calvin Hendricks Parker on a long time ago, very early in this generation of stuff. And he was working with this company that was like Farmer's Almanac kind of company. And they had mm-hmm. mass amounts of old data in almanacs. And they were trying to create a bot, if you will, that you could ask these questions of it and have, you know, this larger corpus of information available. And so RAG was the tool to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But what I was thinking about when you're talking about this multi-step process, you know, inside of doing RAG and it grabbing one of these documents and trying to vectorize it and turn it into something that is usable for the LM to be augmented with this information, mm-hmm. you're saying that there could be this additional step that said, well, how good of a job did you do of that in this task? And maybe you could say, no, do it again. Is that kind of the idea that it could have a grading process to say that, oh, this isn't up to snuff. Like I need you to maybe add these additional steps or something to get a better result.
Yeah. And it's fairly easy to do with DSPy.
Okay.
But yeah, you can do it with the retrieval step and you can do it with the generation step. So in that example, if someone asks questions about the, you know, history of the almanacs, so it says, well, in, you know, 19 65, how many inches of rain did you have?
Right.
Or how many inches were predicted, something, whatever question it is. You can have a retrieval step where you go to a vector store or a graph database or relational database, whatever your source is. And then it can retrieve some information. And then you can have a send that to a critic and say, send it to a an LLM and say, is this enough information to answer this question? And if it's not, what other information should we retrieve?
Okay.
And
like add sources or things like that. Like,
well, yeah,
augment this with more stuff.
Augment it. Like maybe some terminology in there that's not explained. Yeah, like, I guess come up with a contrived example, but say, in the year in which we had the rain, what county had the most rain and what was the average temperature in that's maybe overly convoluted, but maybe a question might more realistically, in the year in which we had the most rain, which county had the most rain and how many inches did it have?
Right.
So it's kind of a multi-step question. So first you would have to, retrieve the rain per year and then figure out which year had the most rain. And then you would have to figure out how many inches each county had.
Right. So you're adding these comparison metrics that gives an idea to the farmer, in this case, the scope of like where that landed inside of that.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think, to answer the question properly, you would have to retrieve enough information out of your data.
Yeah.
In order to even have, so you can have a critic just says, have I retrieved enough information to even send this to the LM to produce an answer yet? And, in some cases, yes. So some of the chunks may answer the question, but they use jargon, like terminology that's not been explained. So you have to say, okay, I have to go figure that out. Or you can say, okay, I've now figured out which, in this sort of example I just gave, you may say, okay, I've now figured out which year had the most rain. Now I have to go figure out how many inches of rain each county had.
Okay.
So I have to, retrieve that. And then eventually it can say, okay, I think you've retrieved enough chunks of text or, whatever sort of data you have out of your data stores. Now I can send it to the generator and it can send that to, say, it could, and you can give it the user's original question plus, whatever information you've retrieved out of your data base, send that and get a response. But then a critic can also look at that and say, have I answered the question yet? And if not, is it because I didn't retrieve enough information or is it because the generator just didn't understand the question properly or, whatever the issue was? It can just loop until you're satisfied you got a good answer to your question. That's one workflow.
Yeah.
And it's an example of a fairly involved. And, there's workflows that are much more complicated than that. Like one example I go through in the book is where you ask, come up with a business plan for something.
Okay.
Or you ask it to do something that's really quite a big job. Well, it has to break that into steps to really do a good job of that, probably. So one of the first things you do is say, okay, what are the high-level steps that we should break this into? And, so maybe it comes back with 10 steps. Each of those, you just keep breaking into smaller and smaller chunks until they're small enough that an LM can answer each one of those chunks quite well. Then you have answers to all these sub-questions and you have more LLM calls where you kind of consolidate these into a coherent, consistent response. Then once all that is working well, you pass that back. So you can have these kind of complex workflows that were actually involved many calls to LLMs and possibly other tools.
Yeah.
It just helps you ensure you get a good quality response.
Yeah. Let me dive into your example in the book then a little more. Mm-hmm. The premise, let me see if I'm getting this right, that you're creating like maybe a web service, like, hey, start your own LLC or start your own business, make your own business plan and this thing will help you. Okay. So in your signature, you're having to define the types of things you need. Okay. Like source of funding, what is the type of thing that you're going to do? You're defining, all the things that a typical business plan has within it as, fundamental building blocks as part of the signature thing. Like this is what makes up a business plan. And also you might be asking the person, right? Like, these questions for them to fill in.
Potentially. Yeah.
And then from there, you're having it build the prompts that would work based upon that input, you know, like the different modules, like, okay, for, you know, this, it's an LLM that's going to go and find all the tax related information or what have you. Am I getting kind of this together? Like some, what you're trying to do?
Yeah. I think, yeah, that would be a reasonable approach. You can also just assume that the LLM probably knows how to create a business plan.
Okay.
And just let it decide. Or you could do exactly what you just said would be the other approach, where you say, you give it some guidance and say, you know, at minimum, I want a section on tax planning and then a section on human resources and a section on marketing. And
okay.
You can give it some guidance and list out what you would like, or you can just let it go off.
Would you include then what you're talking about, like the, for it to be able to sort of judge against these examples, like existing ones?
Yeah, you would want it to be able to evaluate the answer well.
Okay.
Because, you know, you're wanting to automate this whole process. And what you would normally do with DSPI and with, you know, systems like this is use a technique called LLM as a judge, which means you get one LLM to evaluate the responses of another LLM.
Okay.
That's actually, it sounds a little risky. And it can be. Often what you would do if you're doing that is you get a really powerful LM to act as the judge. So it's going to be a little bit more expensive, but you're only going to need it when you're creating your prompt. Once you go into production, you can hopefully use a much more inexpensive LM.
It's kind of like the, you know, building the models themselves. Like that's the most expensive outlay is like...
Yeah. Oh, by far. Yeah. It's a similar idea.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's a one-time. Well, it's not one time. You do have to tune these fairly often. But it's maybe once a year, once every, you know, twice a year or something, you go through this process. And maybe in production, it's...
Depending on which models you're using now.
Yeah. Depending on how busy your application is, maybe you're processing, you know, hundreds or thousands of requests a day. So, yeah, using LLM as a judge, well, it solves a lot of problems. One is it's very efficient. So if you want to test hundreds of possible business plans... or hundreds of possible prompts to generate business plans, then you can automate that still. And it'll come up with evaluations of each. And it can run, you know, if it's a huge process, you want to run for hours, that's not a problem. But one of the big things that LLM as a judge provides is that it's consistent, which, I mean, there's a certain amount of randomness to LLMs, but there's not the biases or... sort of cognitive biases, things like that you get with when people try and judge things.
Right.
Like, you know, if we're asked to read 100 summaries or 100 critiques of...
That's what I was just thinking. Yeah, the exhaustion. Trying to do code review is something we talk about.
Yes. Yeah, like with code review, it's recommended to only do it for like maybe an hour max or something, right? Because after a while, you get sloppy.
Yeah.
And yeah, if you're trying to... critique the responses you get back from LLM. I mean, to do that consistently, you know, for hours is almost impossible. But you know, a machine can do that.
Right. That's what they're really good at.
Yeah, so that's what they're really good at. Exactly. Yeah.
You had a note in your book from Richard Sutton, kind of about this like progression of things. The article, I guess, was called The Bitter Lesson, right?
Yeah.
And how he felt like the biggest lesson that you could read from 70 years of AI research is general methods that leverage computation are ultimately the most effective and by a large margin. And so that's kind of what you're, you know, we're talking about here is this idea of applying the techniques that hopefully take a lot of the guesswork in some ways, like a lot of other people have worked on these ideas, have worked on different methodologies for prompting and different methodologies for judging things and avoid the exhaustion of humans in the loop, potentially. And not that, you know, they still need to be there and the output still needs to be something that is usable for the whole team to understand what's happening in it.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's definitely these things that you should, you know, let the things that are good at do this.
Yeah. We can't eliminate having people evaluate, do a certain amount of work evaluating these. But the sort of tedious work of trying the same prompt with the same LM, with the same input over and over and over again.
Yeah.
That we can, you know, farm off to an LM. And just, yeah, save ourselves a lot of time. And it can do it in like, you know, faster than we can. It can work without breaks. It can... Yeah, it's consistent. Like if you have a bunch of LM responses and we're trying to figure, you know, you're trying say they asked your optimizer to create, you know, 300 candidate prompts, and you're trying to figure out which is the best, and you have, say, 50 test cases that you want to use to evaluate each of those. So that's, you know, 300 times 50. It's a lot of work. And what's really ideal, if you can do it, is with each of those 50 test cases, test each of them multiple times, just because, you know, LLMs are random and, you know, they might, you know, given the same prompt and the same.
I think most people have seen that in the results.
They're different. Yeah. Sometimes they're actually better than other times. They're not just slightly different. They're like way different, depending on the LLM. But yeah. With the assumption that, you know, you might be trying to use some, DSPI might allow you to use some fairly inexpensive LLMs, or you're just not sure. It's an LLM that's new to you and you're not sure how consistent it will be.
Yeah.
If you want consistency, you know, sometimes you don't want consistency too. You want it to like brainstorm creative ideas, and you know, you want to actually test for diversity of responses, not for consistency. So,
sure.
But yeah, trying to do that manually is very hard too. Whereas, you give it to an LLM as a judge, and it can just say, okay, on a scale from 1 to 10, it has, you know, this level of accuracy and this level of diversity, and you know, this is how this prompt worked with this LLM.
So you mentioned a couple of other things that are in the book. Are you generally building a singular application, or how's the book kind of structured?
We go through a few examples. We start with a quite simple one, which is intent classification. So,
okay,
like if you're building a chatbot or something, and the user, say customer service agent, as an example, and users come in with certain types of queries, but it tends to be the same type of queries over and over again. So one of the first steps you might do is just try and figure out, you know, classify what the intent is. So that's a LLM-based classification. And that's a fairly simple case. It's a common case. It's real. People do that all the time. So we start with that. And doing that, we can explain all the DSPI concepts fairly easily. So they're right. All pretty clear. And
keep, you know, all of it in your head.
Yeah, keep all of it in head, because you're not having to think about, you know, a complex situation, really. And then we go on, we cover summarization.
Okay.
And we get into reg systems, agents, working with memory, chatbots, you know, LLM applications like that, where you want to keep some memory of the work it's done, or how it's interacted with people or other applications.
Okay.
We handle MCP as well, how DSPI okay. interacts with that.
What part of the flow does MCP come into? Is that part of like the modules or optimizing, or where does that kind of come in?
I would say it's a way to create agents that work with tools. So one thing DSPI lets you do is work with tools that can, well, perform it. Anything you do in Python, you can do. So with how DSPI handles tools is it's just you provide a Python function that perform some action. So maybe it sends an email, or it makes a purchase, or it updates a database, or schedules an appointment, whatever it does. You just provide a Python function that does that, and you just have to document what the parameters are. And then you can create in DSPI agents. So you say, well, here's the task I have to perform. I got a request from a user or request from another piece of software. And here's the task I have to perform. So, and here's the tools I have to perform it. So if you want to perform this task, we have an email tool, we have a update Jira tool, we have a web scraping tool, and you know, we have a query, a relational database tool. And and so it has, these are the tools available to you. Decide what steps you want to take, and then specify the next task, if it's a tool, and specify what parameters to give that tool. So then it'll call that Python function, giving it the parameters specified, and then it'll ask the LLM, say, okay, here's what you've said to do so far. Here's the last tool execution we performed. Here's the response we got back from that. What do we need to do next to execute what we're supposed to be doing right now? And it'll just kind of loop until it's executed enough tools to perform that. So with MCP, what it lets you do is work with remote tools. DSPI provides infrastructure where you can create your own MCP server. So if you create these sort of tools, you don't have to duplicate the code at all, or even put it in a library. You can just set up a MCP server, and then all of your applications can use that. So if you write a tool that updates a database, you just have to write that once, create an MCP server for that, and then all your other applications can call that. So, or with your DSP application, as well as calling your own tools, you can call tools that other people provide through their MCP servers.
Okay. If somebody was just looking to get started in playing around with DSPy, like, do you have some advice for, I mean, obviously they should check out your book.
Yeah.
But do you have other advice for people getting going?
That would be a little self-serving, but one thing I would say, as good as DSPy is, the documentation isn't fantastic, but it's probably good enough to get started.
Okay.
And the documentation is getting slowly getting better. But if you just want to create, like, you know, hello world type applications where you just ask a large language model, you know, what's the capital of France? And it comes back with Paris. That is literally like 5 or 6 lines of DSPy code. And they're very simple. And once you have that, you're off and running. You now have a working DSPy LLM application.
Yeah.
And, you know, you've not optimized your prompt yet, you've not evaluated it, and, you know, you've not added a complex workflow to it where it, you know, ask the LLM like 10 times and it takes the best. You don't have a complex workflow to answer your question, but you have a working system, and that's actually really easy to do.
Yeah. Do you have an example?
Oh, an example of that? Well, certainly one of the first ones in the book handles that. And I think, yeah, the DSPy documentation, I think, has, you know, simple examples like that.
Yeah. I saw that in the tutorials.
Yeah.
Kind of going through some of it. Yeah.
You really just need an API key for whatever LLM you're using. And if it's a self-hosted model, like you're using Ollama, you don't even need that. But you need to set up Ollama.
Right.
And then you're good. And then, yeah, the work to evaluate a prompt isn't that much more code. It's only a little bit more code.
Okay.
Yeah, the hard part, I say, is just get a bunch of test cases. But, you know, even if you weren't using DSPy, you were just manually trying to come up with a good prompt for your application, you'd still really need these test cases. You know, in practice, people skip them.
That helps.
Yeah. They just hope that their prompt works well.
Yeah. Yeah, I was thinking about, like, do you have an example of, like, how it improved a prompt for you, like, that... Yeah, as you were kind of exploring this, what did it take, like, this sort of simplistic prompt, and then how did it kind of help expand it? Do you have anything you can think of, like, as an example there?
That happened to me a lot, and I'm trying to think how to explain. Yeah, often with the more sophisticated optimizers, it can come up with quite long prompts.
Sure.
You know, working with DSPy, you don't really need to look at the prompts. It's kind of like...
You're maybe not reading them as much.
Yeah, you don't really need to. It's kind of, you know, handled at a lower level. But, you know, out of curiosity once in a while. And some of them are quite sophisticated. But just as you're asking, what's coming to my mind first is one paper I read where people had pitted human prompt engineers against DSPy.
Okay.
And this was, I think that they gave the human like 12 hours, or like some huge amount of time to try and engineer a prompt. And DSPy actually did better than it, and in like, you know, considerably less time. But what DSPy, the prompts it was coming up with were weird. I never would have thought of. And one of them, it went into this like Star Trek kind of speak, where it's kind of like, you know, talking about like your time coordinates and whatever. It's just something I never would have thought of, but it actually worked better than phrasing it like a person would.
Yeah, so I was thinking about, like, it knows how to speak the way the computer or the LLM wants it to speak.
Yeah, like, for whatever reason, it just happened to see something in its training data that you would never guess. And the LLMs kind of have a sense of that and can just come up with these prompts. And, you know, sometimes the prompts they come up with, they'll be, like, written in, like, JSON or like they'll be highly structured in a way that, to me, as a human, I actually find harder to read. I mean, it's not that hard, but harder to read than prose. But an LLM might find easier.
Yeah, I saw this good video on, I think it was like a Databricks conference, talking a little bit about a DSPy.
Mm-hmm.
And this person worked for this sort of open mapping software, and they had a problem in it, which is basically, you know, you have two entries being, you know, put into the map, and potentially they have the same address, but like, you know, are these the same thing? Mm-hmm. And so like their initial prompt is like, determine if two points of interest refer to the same place. So that's their simplest of like starting point.
Yeah.
Yeah, and this is the prompt that they got out of it as an example as part of it. I'll just read part of it. But given two records representing place or business, each with at least a name and address, analyze the information and determine if they refer to the same real-world entity. Consider minor differences such as case, diacritics, transliteration, abbreviations, or formatting as potential. It just keeps going on and on. You can see how like very, very detailed and very, very step-by-step, you know, again, that might be hard for a human to think of all these different little elements like, that are in there.
Eventually you might.
And so I think it's a good example.
Yeah, it is.
I'll keep a link to it.
Yeah. I think it sounds like a good example. And I think all those things that, yes, you might think of a lot of them, maybe not all of them, or eventually all of them,
right.
But they can actually make a difference. Like an LLM can respond differently if you include these sections or don't.
Yeah.
In ways that are really unintuitive. And also, as new LLMs keep coming out, we don't right away know all the tricks that work well with them.
Yeah.
So we kind of have to rediscover this whole process over and over again. And it's exhausting. It's to do it manually is, like my example of the assembly.
Get some tools to help you out.
Yeah. But I'm thinking, just like going back to my example of the assembly code, I'm just thinking now, it's kind of like, not only do you have to learn to write your own assembly code, but imagine you had to write new assembly code like constantly for every piece of hardware you're on.
Right.
So it's kind of like that. Like, not only do you have to learn if you use a manual.
Yeah, this one has this new chip in it or whatever.
Yeah, so you have different assemblies. Yeah. So like here, not only would you have to, if you're still writing prompts manually, not only would you have to learn all the tricks for each LLM, but you would have to learn them all over again for each LLM you want to try.
Right.
Or you can have an LLM.
Right. This one has this context window.
Context window. Exactly. How big it can handle. Yeah. How much context rot do they get? Like, maybe they have a window of a certain size, which is relevant, but also if you give it too much data, it treats it like noise after a bit.
It
falls apart. Whereas this other LLM, maybe that's less of an issue, at least if you phrase the prompt like this, this way or that way. So LLMs can be quite good at that, but I'm thinking like even where LLMs aren't always good at that, just because it's, they're writing prompts for another LLM that's new to it too.
Yeah.
Even if they're not that great at it, they can still go through the process of experimentation and optimization. So where they try a certain prompt that works well in some ways and poorly in some ways, they learn from that. They come up with a bunch of other prompts, try those. Yeah, like I mentioned the one optimizer, which kind of uses this hill climbing technique, but the others use kind of more sophisticated methods still, like the one called MePro uses, Bayesian optimization, and one called GEPA, or sometimes JEPA pronounced, uses a genetic algorithm combined with a Pareto front, and really quite a sophisticated method to try and
lots of interesting techniques hiding in these optimizers.
Yeah, it's kind of things really hard to do manually because you just a lot to keep track of in your head. You say, when I worded the prompt this way, it worked well in these test cases, but had these subtle issues with these test cases. Now, if I try this other prompt, it's just a huge amount you'd have to keep track of in your head if you wanted to kind of reproduce that process. But, using LLMs and keeping them, this Python code that DSPy has provided to keep a history of how well each prompt you've tried has worked and where it's worked well and where it's worked poorly. Yeah, you just kind of save yourself all that.
Yeah. So how can people check out the book?
Well, manning.com, Manning Publishing. You get it directly from there.
Okay.
After a while, it'll be available from a lot of places. I think O'Reilly tends to resell the books and different booksellers and online booksellers, and I'm hoping to get it into bookstores, physical stores.
Yeah.
But unless you have a large one in your city, probably you better get it off online. So just going to manning.com is probably the best thing right now.
Yeah, cool. Well, cool link for it there.
The first chapter of the book is available for free on Manning's site. So if you read that, you should have a sense if it's useful for any of the projects you're working on or may work on.
Yeah. Let people check that out and get an idea of like some of the stuff behind it. And a lot of the stuff that I quoted in the in what we've talked about today is from that. So, all right. Well, I like to ask everybody who comes on the show, what's something they're excited about that's happening in the world of Python?
Okay. Well, as always, lots of things. One of them is tabular deep learning models. In my work, my day jobs, and so on, you know, the bulk of my work has been working with tabular data.
Okay.
You know, sometimes I work with other modalities, but, you know, the bulk of it's table data. And if you're trying to make predictive models, machine learning models, well, because I've been at this a long time, I remember when random forest was kind of the state of the art, or SVMs. And then, you know, XGBoost came out, then LGBM, and CatBoost has been the state of the art, you know, generally for, I think, over a decade. And it just, you know, people kept trying to find ways to apply deep neural networks to table data.
Okay.
And it never worked really well. It worked okay. And one thing we found too is that, you know, combining deep learning methods with, you know, other methods, boosted models and random forests and KNN models and so on, would work even better, but just because they were different. They would add some diversity to an ensemble. But on their own, they never were really competitive with CatBoost. But now, you know, after decades of trying, we're starting to come up with models that are competitive. You know, some of that actually even outperforming CatBoost.
Okay.
And that's really exciting. You know, after all these years, you make another, not massive, but a small step in terms of this sort of accuracy we can get out of predictive models now.
Is there a particular library that does the tabular deep learning?
There are, and I'm blanking on the names of them right now. I just remember TabNet was the one.
You can send some links to me and we can include them in the show notes.
I'll make a note to do that.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm just worried that if I go by memory, I'm going to come up with random acronyms. TabNet was the one I used to look at years ago, and it was never performed all that well.
Okay.
And it still doesn't perform that well, but there are a bunch of alternatives now that they use it. And it's a really interesting technique.
Okay.
And yeah, how they created them is really interesting too, with the use of synthetic data.
What's something that you want to learn next? This doesn't have to be about programming. Could be like, I want to learn welding is my next thing I want to try to learn.
Yeah. You know, well, did you learn welding when you were in school?
No, I had shop class back in the day, and you know, I did some woodwork and a little tiny bit of metal work, but never quite to the point of actually welding things together. This is junior high, so that's a long time ago.
Yeah. Oh, same with me. Yeah. But I did learn welding back in.
Okay.
And I had a job as a welder one time. And then years later, like 25 or 30 years later, I had an MRI. And one of the questions asked is, have you ever worked as a welder? Yeah, as a summer job when I was in high school. Anyway, they had to be careful that I didn't have bits of metal stuck in my eye somewhere.
Interesting. Change your imaging.
Well, not that. It's that the MRI can accelerate the pieces of metal to, like, I forget what it is, thousands of miles an hour. Okay. And it would, yeah, rip through your,
not great,
your body. Anyways, I didn't have one and I was fine. I've always kind of wanted to go back to welding. But yeah, one thing, talking to you before we went on air, is I would like to learn guitar.
Okay.
And I have learned a bunch of instruments over the years, some better than others. But yeah, I just bought a guitar for one of my kids, and she's learning it. And I
acoustic, electric?
She got an acoustic.
Okay, cool.
I remember when I was in high school, I mean, I guess I grew up in the suburbs in the 80s, and
sure,
a lot of us learned instruments, and a lot of people became really, really good. And it was kind of inspiring. No, they also put in enormous numbers of hours. I have heard, you know, when you're older, it does take a little longer, but it's doable still.
Yeah, and sometimes it feels like getting your muscles in the right, you know, kind of shape. This person I talked to recently was wanting to learn golf now, and then, you know, like, comparing to maybe teaching his son at the same time. So I don't know if you all have a similar experience with your daughter there and watching their progress learning.
Yeah, I think, but you know, if my goal is not to become master, my goal is just to become
just have fun.
Good and have fun. And I think I just enjoy it. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. What's the best way that people can follow your work online?
I would say on Medium and towards data science. I publish articles in both of those.
Okay.
And LinkedIn, if you look for, W. Brett Kennedy. Yeah, I've written a bunch of articles on DSPy, more on interpretable machine learning, outlier detection, optimizations, yeah, and other topics like that. So yeah, if anyone's interested in anything like that, that's probably a good place to find it.
All right. We'll include those links in the show notes also. Thanks again, Brett, for coming on the show again.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
I want to thank Brett Kennedy for coming back on the show this week. And I want to thank you for listening. If you like the episode, a great way to help us grow our audience is to share it with other Python users who you think might enjoy it. You can also leave a rating or a review on your podcast platform of choice. If you or your company are interested in sponsoring the podcast, you can find all the information at realpython.com/advertise. You can find show notes with links to the topics we spoke about inside your podcast player or at realpython.com/podcast. And while you're there, you can leave us a question or a topic idea. I've been your host, Christopher Bailey, and I look forward to talking to you soon.